go to thecognitiverampage.com. Feel free to contribute, donate, keep fueling the change, whatever it is that you guys can do to help continue to allow this to happen. None of this would happen without you and your love and your support and, of course, your contributions. Love you.
Welcome to Cognitive Rampage Podcast. Hope you're taking care of you. Hope you're living your cognitive rampage. My book, The Cognitive Rampage, A Scientific Approach to Self-Discovery, Change, and Life Optimization, is now available on Amazon. What I do in the book is I fuse the latest research from the cognitive, behavioral, social, environmental, and biological sciences. It's not just motivational fluff and wordplay. Now, I do talk about my own story, so there's some kind of inspiration in there, but I'm not just spinning words and hyping you up with motivational fluff. Whether you need a life change, simply enjoy self-exploration and optimization, want to discover new hidden passions, or reduce the life-altering effects of toil, anxiety, depression, all of those issues, this book is for you. This book is not a cookie-cutter method of steps to follow. You'll customize the scientific framework with your own personal beliefs to build your authentic change. That way you assimilate it faster and quicker. It's not just copying my beliefs and telling you step one, step two. These will come from your beliefs as how you extend and build the foundation upon this framework. You'll use this framework throughout your whole life, through every change, and through every age. These are not empty words of motivational spin. This book is an experience. The Cognitive Rampage is based in science and is built from your beliefs. It's a path to help you unleash your desired change. You can apply this method on your own with no harmful side effects. You can simply go to Amazon.com, search The Cognitive Rampage, and you'll find the second edition there, as well as the Kindle version. The audiobook is going to be released sometime in June. Sometime in June, I will have the audiobook of the second edition available as well. My guest on the podcast today, myself. I got to have like a better intro that connects. Because the intro, if you listen to the podcast, is getting repetitive. I promise I'll put the audiobook out soon. But since it just jumps into the podcast, right? Usually I have the guest on. So it's my guest today is. So I just figured I'd keep that for a little bit. I think the guest may just be me for a bit until those other hosts take over and start. They have a few people lined up. I know Alex Price, you were talking to me today, had a few people lined up, and Philip as well. Looking forward to those that I did invite to host to continue to bring the shows and the people that they lined up. They've lined up, including themselves, and do your own rampages. But this is as... I'm just hashtagging everything I'm saying here with tyranny of words, okay, that I understand. Read that book, reference that, look that up a minute, okay? So with that in mind, which is why I titled the opening of this Leadership, really, because when we get into so many subjective ideas of what leadership is, we start to get on shaky ground. We really do. From a science perspective, especially on what leadership is, we can study what leadership is socially, what it means in other groups, why we look up to it, why we could explain certain attachments, all kinds of research out there about social theory and social influence to groups and why we seek that or connection of some kind, right? But leadership perhaps may be a social construct that's been passed down through human evolution, right? We follow the fastest, the biggest, the smartest, the richest, seemingly the most corrupt these days. But I'm going to talk a little bit about leaderships. What leadership myths, really, I should say. And then I'm going to give you my meandering opinion at the end of what I think it takes to be a leader, at least what I see or what I may follow. Because I'm going to ask you a few questions on the rampage as well through here that if you participate or write down or just think about, it's fun to walk through. But, basically, I'm going to start out with three myths and then at the end, give you those opinions. And I'm going to cover a lot of stuff in between there. So feed you with a fire hose as the Cognitive Rampage typically would do. But I want to start out first by telling you my story, right? Transparent. I'll be vulnerable to you by opening up like I normally do, part of my life or a story or something that impacted me. So for one, being off of the mic for 2 weeks. I was trying to go 30 days. I really was. But man, it was a flow state thing for me, right? It's something that I love to do is share that, be transparent, open up, ask questions to people, share my perceptions of life, my own meandering, as I like to say. But it's been a minute. You know, when I took these 2 weeks off and just kind of breathed and stepped away for a little bit, being back on the mic again, man, you may hear it in me. It's almost nerve-wracking, right? For me, I can feel it, right? It's almost like that entry into the wave before you catch it, right? That first wave, or if you're a freestyler or a poet or a painter or whatever, right when you're taking that first leap, if you will, that first paddle, that first nervousness of the day or whatever, it kind of feels good, right? Catching that flow state, right? That enthusiasm. That's what I like, I guess, to think about, is the enthusiasm that I feel when I sit down and get to do this and share this with you. So this story takes place back when I was doing intern. I had completed most of the study. I talk about it in my book. I didn't study. I trained. I read books that surrounded the books, those that wrote the textbooks, trainers' books, and probably deeper into that. I probably went too far, maybe, if that's such a thing. But I felt like I was in a race to save my own life, right? So as I'd gotten through 3 years of schooling, it was time to now apply that knowledge as an intern. And Leo, who I write about in my book a lot, I kind of consider, my first real full life mentor. Dr. Jan Burt was there as well. He's been a full life mentor now, a friend of mine. But Leo was around at this influential moment. He was my supervisor interning. Now, Leo has tons of experience, right? The man ran giant private practices, interned, did research for many years. So a lot of competence and experience, but a quiet confidence too. But anyway, I think Leo saw me coming from like a mile away, right? Like, he had seen this, I'm going to change the world, I'm going to learn something and help people and, you know, dive right in. And he treated me differently. Probably the best handler my mind in development process possibly ever had in such a short period with a focus on the topic. But Leo's teaching kind of bled into my life as well. And that's why I quote Leo, Leo D'Annibal Jr., by the way. Love you, brother. That's why he's quoted in the book so much. He passed down tons of wisdom. And when I asked myself, right, if you ask yourself the question, who's a good leader, right? Who's a leader to you? And a lot of people may pick out topics, right? A leader in what, though, right? Do they lead in this, lead in this? I don't know. I'm just going to talk about leadership as just kind of an umbrella term, right? Allow your subjectivity to attach that to any form you wish, right? I'm trying not to intrude too much on the rules of the tyranny of words. So that's why I'm kind of dissecting it from a personal transparency, like looking at it with stories. But Leo, to me, matched what a leader was. He was in a difficult work environment. A lot of weight was on his back on how it operated, but didn't get to make a lot of the executive decisions, but had to employ them. And employing those on overworked, underpaid counselors is a difficult job while teaching and working interns at the same time, especially a overconfident, excited wannabe counselor. And anyway, I watched Leo for a few groups. Now, mind you, this is picking up from my third day of internship. I'd met Leo once or twice, and only recently for a day or so had seen him in action when he was working a group, when he was doing a group. So he was a director, so he'd fill in for others and sometimes to help out other counselors, etc. But when he worked a group, it was so genuine. I was like, man, I want to do it like that, right? That was my thoughts. Like, man, I want to be able to really work like that. And so anyway, fast forward, it's about 3 days, right? And it's about three groups a day is what we would do. And now Leo's done the first two groups and we're ending the day with this third group as usual. We had a lunch, we broke. Anyway, we're probably 5 minutes from third group time. And Leo goes, you're doing the next group. Now, mind you, on my paperwork, I'm not supposed to do a group for like 6 months, right? So it wasn't even really on my thought plate to have to run a group, right? So I immediately was like, oh, wait, what? Leo's like, yeah. I'm like, well, what's the topic? And he goes, whatever you want to be, just do the group. He didn't pigeonhole me, right, into any corner. So I kind of panicked. I was like, well, I didn't want to be the intern counselor I had seen before where no disrespect, but you'd sit down and just pass out the daily, sheet they'd give you to give to the group, kind of read aloud and go through the worksheet. I didn't want to do that. So anyway, 10 minutes, that 5 minutes or whatever it was before a group went by, like it was 30 seconds. So I just really grasped from my experience. So what I did is, the first thing I did is I took the chairs out of a circle kind of and pushed them a little bit more square. And on one side, I moved the desk, right? I always thought the desk that they use when they ran groups kind of gave this authoritative figure, and I didn't like that. So I moved the desk out of the way and then operated within that open circle of chairs and behind me on my whiteboard. Now, I became kind of the guy at that place that used the whiteboard, right? I was furiously, I'd write on that board and help people understand, right? I'd get real intense, hence the birth of the cognitive rampage. So let's just say a lot of it came unleashed within that first year. Well, I worked the board that first day, right? I got to take you back there. I walk in and I just go, let's do the ABCs. And so I went to Ellis, something I had read before I really even started studying or wanted to be a mental health counselor. And I went right back to Ellis and the basics, right, that I kind of learned myself. So instead of coming from this authoritative therapist figure, I wanted to come from like a student, perspective, knowing that life was subjective anyway. If I could get that out there, then maybe I could teach something. So what I wanted to do, rather than hold some knowledge that I had or something that I had learned or learned from someone else, rather than hold that and kind of arrogantly work that out in some way, I just said, hey, look, here's the equation. Here's what the cognitive sciences say, right? And I worked the ABCs, right? The action, belief, the C. There's an activating event, right? But action, you have a belief about that event. Then you have consequences based on that belief, right? So I just covered the basics, but I was interactive, asking questions, right? Just kind of posing like, hey, this is just what the guy says, right? Well, it went over pretty good. Let's just say I enjoyed it, right? And I got this feedback where people are like, holy shit, I never looked at that way. And I'm like, yeah, me either. When I read the book, it was crazy. And, Leo didn't really critique it at all. He just was like, good job, right? He just kind of left it at that. Well, fast forward about a year and I'm writing the book along the way. I'm developing transrational structure behavior theory. Like I said, I came out of the gates like, holy shit, like we're going to do something crazy. We got to invent a new theory. We got to dive into this, right? So at the same time, he's watching that development over the years. And let's just say I got him in trouble sometimes because let's just say my rampages, I would use what they call bad words or curse words, if you can believe that. And I would say these bad words and rampages, but as I was kind of teaching, et cetera, and, you can't do that. So it was frowned upon. So sometimes even the rampage kind of became something that I would deliver. And what I didn't know I was really working on, I was working on the theory. But as I worked on the theory, it was coming out in different group activities and lessons that I was doing over the years. So and that's kind of how the book shaped, right? So sometimes I would get a little aggressive, right? And I would get really into it as I was teaching it, right? I was almost preaching it, and it was really aggressive, and a lot of people would attach and a lot of people would detach the minute the curse word came out or it was too in your face, right? This is where I developed the line, kick in your front door psychology, because that's kind of what I applied. Leo would always laugh and say, well, I climb in the window psychology, so I'm upstairs waiting in the mine when they get up there. So he would kind of have that sneak in the back door, which he would do mentally on me so many times that, right what I was thinking, what I was edging to. But anyway, the point is he didn't really critique me at all. He didn't offer his advice for almost a straight year. He just kind of dealt with the hassle I was to be a therapist. But I also picked up a lot of slack when I could. I would do full groups to give therapists breaks to catch up on their charts and stuff, which means they would put all four groups with me and I would do some kind of lesson or something, right? Or just teach something. I would just teach what I was learning, or what I had learned in psychology. Anyway, about a year goes by and Leo finally invites me to lunch, which we ate lunch a lot of times, but he invited me to lunch and he asked me, I can't do it like him, right? He just walked my ass right into basically admitting and saying that I have to act that way and I have to use curse words to get this message across when I'm delivering it. Well, that meant I had to challenge my own shit. Dang, I cursed. I was trying to make this whole thing. I had to challenge my own theories, right, with my own beliefs and go, man, no, Leo, it won't work. It won't have the same delivery. It really won't. I can't pitch it that way. I can't talk that way or teach it. I had my first speech was coming up too that was locally there in Naples. And begrudgingly, I listened to him. And I didn't want to, but I did. So I walk in, I do the rampage, if you will, teaching TSBT. And I did it from the chair with no whiteboard. And I don't think I said a curse word. I'm pretty sure. But we can never trust our memories, right? I'd like to think I didn't. But I didn't deliver it with the whiteboard as usual. He always told me the whiteboard made me feel safe. So I had to like get away from it. And I did the whole group, just like he said, kind of more monotone and relaxed. And I'll be dang. He was right. Because he told me, he said, look, if the people that don't mind the approach or the cursing, if you will, let the message in, then they will without it. And the people that automatically turn you off, even if it's their own perception, automatically turn you off and the message then reached more people. I said, yeah, but that's their own perception. They can change it, right? I was very forceful. Like I said, a pain in the butt to work with. But anyway, right after I did that group and it went over great, I immediately called him and actually I can't curse, but he said hello and I simply just said, F you. Then he knew, right? And he had his favorite line where he go, and how about that? And I just, man, in all despair, right? So the fact that he listened to me for nearly a year, he let me cultivate my own practice. He offered advice and the theories and things that I would ask. He didn't once really tell me to come off and say, hey, tone this down, teach this more. He'd just say, hey, try not to curse, right? You're getting me in trouble. And I would keep going because he knew I was coming from a genuine place. And I figured out that I couldn't do it like Leo, but what Leo did is he brought genuineness. He really cared about the people he was talking to. And I realized that was something that you couldn't teach or put back in jaded counselors too, you know, because it's a rough system. But he listened to me for a whole year without really critiquing or coaching. And I found that to be quite amazing. And he dealt with me at some choice points when I was responding and learning about a mental health environment that was so corrupt that I couldn't be quiet. And for me, it was a tough time because I was like, man, I spent so much money on this, on that, and now I'm here. It was a trying time for me, but he just let me grow. And after that year, he offered a challenge. And for me, that was what I thought a leader was. And the way I saw him handle the executives above him, you know, managing budgets and basically cracking the whip on the counselors, and the way he would manage the counselors and teach the interns and really took an extra mile for the patients, despite the corruption that was there, I saw to be leadership because it was something I over time couldn't bring myself to do from the inside and had to do something, you know, and the rampage was born and the book came out and he helped me out so much by leading that way. So for me, that impact was a leader. So on the idea of leadership, if I asked you, what does it take to be a leader? What do you think is leadership? Think of a couple things. Say, pick anything. I don't want to put a bias in there, right? But I will ask you, is it vision, charisma, credentials, trust, creativity, motivation, passion, right? You need passion and drive, right? Sure. But these are all subjective. None of these are measurable. How do we measure what creativity is? If your leader is creative, well, to who? Are they credentialed? Even nowadays, I mean, look at the issues that peer reviewed means. What funding and grants and that kind of write it, we'll pay for it, research it, we'll pay for it, but don't research that, we won't pay for it. Things you can't do. So credentials even become questionable. Motivation. We already know motivation is subjective. There are no motivated and unmotivated people. Right? Simply just what motivates us. Shout out to Dr. Bobby Hoffman. We haven't talked in a while. But if there was, I don't know, a three-step guide, I don't know, how many books are there on motivation? Matter of fact, how many books are there on leadership? I mean, and I don't know, just my thought, if it was those steps, wouldn't there be just one book, maybe two? What about parenting, relationships? See, there's no master book. There's so many perceptions. If there was just one way, there would just be one book, really, right? I mean, we have to understand that leadership is subjective as to what influences us, right? If Leo's, my calling leadership, doesn't influence me or change my life or have an impact, is that labeled as leadership from the outside? Does the outcome determine whether the leadership was good, right? Does the performance of what we do determine the definition of what we call it, right? If I perform well, if I've made change, if I've changed legislation, if we've opened the nonprofit and donated the money, if we've performed, well, then we can say we're a leader in. I mean, you see it, the big companies in all markets were the number one leader in manufacturing and blah, 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 right? Performance. See, over time, this trickles down to the idea that the only value that we find in our lives or being alive is how we perform in life, how many people we lead, how many people we're helping. We define that, right? We define that if we don't perform, then I have no value. Well, I can tell you a baby doesn't perform much, but does that baby have value? And if so, how would you turn that baby's value, possibly human potential, right? So if a baby really can't perform anything and really needs help to stay alive, by the idea of saying that we have value by how we perform, well, then the baby then would have no value. But it seems to be they have the most value to most of us sane people in the world. Because that baby has human potential, we have no idea what we stunt when we hurt children, when children are starving, right? When they don't perform, we don't pay attention to their mental health along the way. The same with your own mental health is the idea that you have value just simply for having human potential. You have value based, not based on how you perform at anything, whether it's marriage, whether it's your job, parenting even. We have ways to measure those values, but those two are subjective. Is the parent that gives the money more influential than one that does the rearing? How do we measure these things? It's the same idea about leadership. What are the measurements? What do we take? Shit, in our society, it's what we're allowed to choose from, right? Seems like we barely get to choose that. But performance is measured by your effort. That's the best way I could see it. Since we're talking about a performance or a subjective notion, really, of performance, then look at the effort put forth, not the outcome. You are not the performance. The effort you put forth, I think, determines the value of the performance, but not the value of self. We are not that performance. What's the difference between effort and ability? Do you think ability matters most? Do you think effort matters most? Do you play an instrument well? If you play an instrument well, for example, or you do something else well, how did you get that good? How were you able to play that? See, a guy walks into a restaurant. There's a gentleman playing the piano, and he's playing it beautifully. Man leans down at the end of the song and tells the piano man, "I wish I could play like that." The piano man looks back and says, "No, you don't. Because I'm not sure you're willing to put in the effort to play every day, to learn new songs, to push past what you're not able to do with your fingers. Are you willing to do those tasks?" So when you say you wish you could play like this, are you willing to put in the effort to be able to play like this? See, effort is doing the small, tedious things routinely to improve ability. But we can't choose tasks that are outside our ability plus our ability or willing effort. Effort plus our willing ability has to match the task that we choose. See, I used an example earlier today that if I had to go build a rocket and somebody said, "Here's the instructions, go build a rocket," I could have all of the effort in the world. Heck, I could phone a friend. I could call Patricia and say, "Hey, do you know what to do?" I'd call the tribe of change and say, "Hey, I got to build a rocket. I may find somebody," but we can have all the effort in the world, all of the effort in the world. But if we don't even have the ability or the competence to even know what something is that we're putting on something, Well, then the outcome, you know. And then should we judge ourselves by the performance outcome or the effort? But see, if I asked you the question, do you think it's just ability or if you think it's just effort? And you said, well, it's all about effort. I'm going to tell you, no, because I just explained it. If we had all the effort in the world, we're not going to launch that rocket anytime soon. Especially if we don't have more phone or friends. So effort is doing the small, tedious things routinely to improve the ability. When the effort then matches the ability and the tasks you choose, you have a much higher percentage of a desired outcome. Now that's science. You can apply that equation to many things in life, politics, your own life, your job, the next goal, where you want to be. Work it backwards and see where you used to be. It may match. See, if you bite off that task, right? If you just say, hey, I'm going to do all of this, but you don't have the ability, you don't have the effort, well, the place you start is to get competent. Your ability increases with the effort put in plus time and then push repeat. But let's say you do have an ability. What do they call it? A God-given ability? You're just born with it? I know a lot of good singers, and they may have been born with a good voice, but the work that they do to improve that voice is quite tedious and daily, especially the way you take care of your voice. But if you already have the ability, does this mean this is your purpose? See, the myth number three is the purpose myth. Maybe you just need to discover your hidden magic talent. Then you reveal your purpose. Maybe if you put in enough effort to enhance your ability to a master's level, then that will then be your purpose. Then we can define that idea. Wrong. See, we never really know our purpose. This is the purpose myth. We don't know it. But see, that sounded cynical to me. So for me, the purpose myth, the beauty, the silver lining, and the idea that we never really know our purpose, but then we are aware of the attachment to the belief of the idea of a purpose, we can apply that through cognitive structuring and framing to say that our purpose can be anything. We can apply it to given moments, this day, next week, to accomplish things, to be better at this, to do less of this. We can make it. We can say, this is my purpose, because that's the plasticity of it. That's the power and the beauty of the idea. See, it's not just a myth that we don't find our purpose. That's right. But for some reason, we're in tune to the idea of placing a belief that we call a purpose onto what we do or what we choose. So if you're aware of that power, then beautifully use it and apply it as needed. There's no laws. You can't say, nope, you've used your purpose up this year. You can define it to be what it is. And when you define that purpose, then you can make it your purpose. Accomplish it. Follow with the same beliefs that you would if you believe it truly is your purpose. So let's say maybe you found your purpose. Maybe what you're doing is fulfillment. Maybe it's the dream that you admired. Maybe you found the purpose, or we've defined it as that, right? Maybe it's helpful and we've defined it. What you do is your purpose. Then are you the purpose? Is who you are that job, that outcome? Are you the performance? Are you the person who says, I have obtained, acquired, I have followed? What do you do when you're not that? When what you define, whatever label you use to title yourself, is removed. When that goes away, who are we then, right? But when we're aware too, then when we say, this is who I am, if we can be aware that if we define who we are by the actions or events that happen to us, if we define ourselves by the accomplishments, hey, I got the job today, therefore I can be happy. Hey, this happened to me, therefore I can be enthusiastic. I cannot be sad. If these things is what we use to define or allow to manifest into our feelings about our present time, then we don't control how we feel most of the time, because then life controls you. Because when life happens, then whatever happens to you then deems how you feel or even who you are. So when things go well for you, right, you've defined your ability, right? You have pushed forth the effort. You believed we found the purpose. We've pushed through. Now we've become that person. You are the motivational speaker. You are the one speaking, or whatever your dream is. You've made it there. Has your value increased? Matter of fact, if your child performed poorly at an activity, maybe a chosen activity, a science fair, a tournament, a sporting event, a relationship,
on a vacation. Maybe they perform poorly. Do they still have value to you? Of course they do. Did their value change with their performance? So if that's the same love that we bestow on our own kids, then we have to at least apply the same rules of that love to ourselves. So if what you've attempted, what you've tried, what you may have failed at, or even if you've accomplished it and you're sitting at the top of the mountain of it and say, this is then who I am, or this is who I am, that performance does not equal your value. Does it make you better than other people? Does it make you less than other people? Things happen to us in life. We make those choices. We fulfill what we fulfill. We don't what we don't. But they don't define us, and our performance does not define us. The myth recap, if you will, is performance versus value, which I just recapped. The effort versus ability. Ability is something that you can cultivate, something you can grow. And how do you grow your ability? By putting forth the effort to earn the knowledge, to gain the experience, to build the confidence, to then be enthusiastic about your ability, but humble enough in the idea that I have to continue to put forth effort to master that, that they work hand in hand, that I have to match whatever task I choose with the effort I'm willing to put in equal to my ability for a higher success rate. And if I do or if I don't, it's not my purpose. Maybe the purpose was to fail. I cannot define it. But if I choose to believe that purpose is something that is real, then understand that subjective notion can't be applied and we won't learn it. No light pops on that tells you, hey, this is your purpose. You found it. It may just be for the moment, but what a beautiful moment. And you can recreate that cognitively by structuring words toward the next goal. So what does it take? You know what it doesn't take? You can't unlearn what you now know. Another Leoism that he would lay on me after he would sneak in the back door of psychology. I'd figure it out and go, oh man, beep you. And he'd say, yeah, now you can't unlearn what you now know. So I'll give you a couple things that I think are what I admire in leadership that kind of matches to maybe why Leo was one to me. But I understand it's subjective too, and how we apply these words and how we individually seek out leaders for different purposes and different reasons. But I think at least first off for me is self-awareness. You know, no man or woman steps in the same river twice. For we are always changing, and the river is too, right? I use that quote in the book, a little off the cuff of it, but if we're always changing, if we know that, you could say we're always changing, but that could be irrational. We die one day. I guess that's the last change that we know about, right? But I think self-awareness, that allows people to grow. Because when you're self-aware of your actions, your influence, then you can monitor self. You can be more self-analytical and hopefully not as outwardly critical and especially inwardly critical. So for someone that's self-aware of their own weaknesses, their own influences, their own biases, their own cultural and dogmatic influences from their whole lives that are aware of that, and possibly the person that would be self-aware enough to know that no one good person is that leader and would probably deny the position. And for me, maybe that self-awareness and the ability to understand the difference between criticism and analysis, that criticism from leaders you usually don't see, but analysis and observation and solutions and offer to help. I think that takes bravery and courage. That's the second thing. I know these are subjective, and you can beat me up down tyranny words lane. I promise I understand that. That's kind of the point. What is the definition of bravery? Where does the courage come from? You see, I think someone that may show bravery and courage in my perception, well, I think that strength comes from the people that follow you, the people that support you. When you have that group or that surrounding, that supportive group, I think that is what gives you possibly that definition. See, I don't like the term of even declaring oneself a leader. To me, that's something that is bestowed on you. That's a title that's given to you, not something you just snatch out of the sky because you have the ability under your idea. For me, that courage comes from the people that support them, not because they dig deep and, well, it's lonely at the top and there are leaders that just suffer that way. See, Leo supported me because he listened. He didn't criticize me. He analyzed me. He watched me for a year and what I was doing. Before he even meticulously put together his approach to challenge me, he knew my ego would take on the challenge. And then I guess he knew I could do it decently. And so when I applied it and it worked, how about that? He got me. So for me, leaders listen, and I don't see very many political leaders listening today. I see a lot of them pontificating under party affiliate ideas and definitions of what we call freedom. That's not brave and courageous to me. Can you think of a politician? See, that leader doesn't just dig down deep. They listen. So for me, bravery and courage is something that I admire. But the ability and the bravery to listen. I think something about courage and bravery that may be a little different is bravery is you know what will happen and you go. Maybe courage is you don't know what will happen, but you go anyway. I think you could probably flip those two as well. I also think that bravery and courage doesn't always roar. I think when we hear these words, we think about champions, right? People that overcome serious trauma or disadvantages. But for me, the cancer patient or the single mother, or the single father, the hardworking family, where's their Facebook page? Where's their motivational video? See, it doesn't always roar. Bravery and courage can come quietly many times. See, a lot of people like to say that actions are stronger than words, and, well, I would disagree. I mean, think about Martin Luther King, who put together such a large march without the internet, mind you. He pulled that many people together in one location, one idea, and through his words and many others, created action. So for me, the words are necessary to bring people to action. So I think bravery and courage extends into those facets of my definition of a leader. You see, Leo knew where he worked. He knew the trenches that he was in, but he went anyway. He knew a lot of the outcomes of those patients in that system, but he went to the group anyway. He knew a lot of the interns wouldn't even make it through the 6 months and would end up changing careers. A lot of them didn't under Leo. He went anyway. For me, that helped. And his awareness of himself, too, was something to admire, too. He questioned himself on a lot of things, and I'd pick at him sometimes, and he would just kind of say, oh, man, that's true? I'll have to entertain that. He could always take it pretty well. Who do you follow? Have you ever questioned why or who? Who do you look at? I don't just mean follow on social media, but who do you look at as having whatever you define as leader having? Courage, ability, bravery, effort, knowledge. You got to know at least why you follow who you follow. What that belief is. What your belief behind their vision is, their philosophy is. I mean, I think we're all leaders in our own right. We all feed from each other. I write in the second edition that we're all just standing on the shoulders of giants. And I think what was missing in that statement is that we're all giants. And we all stand on the shoulders. Even if you don't write a book or have a theory or have a million downloads, that we all influence. And the third thing that I think it takes is humility and vulnerability. Don't get it twisted. Humility is a practice. It's not something you become. If you find yourself announcing that I'm humble, well, be willing to question yourself. I don't know how much humbleness I'm seeing in our political leaders today. I see a lot of finger pointing, a lot of party pulling. But humility is something we practice. We don't become humble. But in that humility, we can gain competence. If politicians even, I'm just using them as easy targets, right? We're self-aware of the corrupt system, at least admitted to what it was, and then try to make choices behind it, right? And we're brave enough to face them maybe being dismissed or not accepted to a party or getting donors. If they had bravery and courage to know what'll happen to them, but they put their risk out there anyway. And if they're humble enough to be able to challenge themselves and what they believe in their party's actions, and they were vulnerable enough to say, hey, I make those mistakes too, perhaps we'd have real leaders, right? See, without competence, right? Self-competence, competence in a topic you're talking about, without the competence, well, it's kind of arrogance in my opinion. Without humility, we can't grow. We can't get self-competent. To learn, we got to be humble. When I hear leaders or people at the top, and you hear them telling, you know, I referenced it earlier, lonely at the top. I like to say that they're not a leader because they weren't even aware enough to know that no one was following them. Just sitting at the top. It's lonely at the top. Those self-proclaimed, self-made people, you bother the shit out of me. You didn't make it alone. You had a mother at one point, you had a father, and even if you never had them, you had a first client, you had an investor, you had a sister. Grandma, somebody helped along the way. So the arrogance for me that comes from self-made anything, or the phrase lonely at the top, no, it's going to hurt on the way down. Right? You got to be careful who you climb on the way to the top because they're going to have to hold you on your way down. And most of them won't. The leader also knows if you want to go fast, you heard this one, or go alone. If you want to go far, go together. For me, a leader wants to push you beyond themselves. Go beyond what you do, right? Not just coach you to their position. Here's how I do it, but I can't give away my secrets because they need to be vulnerable enough to say, hey, I'm not good at this. Or maybe you can help me with this or be okay with teaching the secret tactics, right? Teaching, hey, I'm not that good at this. Or here's how I get this part done. You see that everywhere, right? Buy my book and sign up to be this. You'll get rich in 3 days. You'll beat depression. You'll come over this, right? You'll fix your whole life if you just do what I say. Not a whole lot of vulnerability in the transparency, the subjectiveness of which we've all used in our own lives, right? It's hard to even tell anybody, hey, I understand what you're going through, unless we have their perceptions or see the life that they're living through their own retinas and are able to process every given emotion at the same time they did at the same time in our lives. It's hard to say, I understand. But being vulnerable enough to say that I too fear, I too worry. I don't see too many politicians saying that. I don't see too many politicians saying, other than I fear some made up hardcore Islamic State that's out to murder us all. I'm not saying that doesn't exist in certain areas and in certain group sizes. But the idea of pitching the fear, not the vulnerability or the compassion toward what people, the working person, and the person struggling in the economy, the student with too much debt, the single moms, the single fathers, those kids that are forgotten, those ones in our educational system, quotes. Do you have sympathy or empathy for us? And are you humble enough to be vulnerable in bad choices you made? Are you open to even say, hey, I've changed my mind due to science and evidence, or I've changed my mind because I've got more competent? You don't see that. See, for me, being vulnerable, self-aware, having bravery and courage, that is leading to me. To connect with those. See, connecting. Leadership's about connecting. If you can connect to the group, how do you do that? How do you connect to anyone? I think it's showing that I'm human. But we all have a tendency, right, to meet the new people and peacock ourselves to what we have, what we've been, what we've owned. Look what I'm wearing. This is what I've done. We've been there. We don't greet with this vulnerable idea that, hi, I'm human and I'm trying to figure out what's going on in this spinning rock in space. But we're doing it, right? We don't share that. Vulnerability brings understanding and connection. That song that you love so much that you play on repeat, you swore it, right? It was written for you. That word you hit repeat goes, oh, that song was written for me, right? Because that's a touch of vulnerability from the writer, from the performer, the one singing that song. There's vulnerability there, and you connect with that through the word. So through that vulnerability is how it touches your own understanding, and that's why you listen over and over and over again. See, for me, in my opinion, leading is about helping others excel beyond you. To lead is to help others go beyond you. I think many of us want to bring people up, help them a little bit, maybe volunteer a little competence, a little experience, volunteer a little money, a little help to bring them up to our level. But are we willing? Would you give up your job to them? Right? I'm just getting crazy. But it's letting those move beyond you. Leo never held me back once. I talked about quitting so many times. I stayed for Leo for a long time. Because he was in it, right? I'm like, I can't leave him, man down. But he's like, you got to go on. Move from here. Keep the show going. Always pushed it. Encouraged me to do it bigger. Do it louder. Never really criticized me. But he tried to push me to go beyond me. And I was forever trying to incorporate him in everything I did. So the best I could do is really quote him more than anybody else in the book. Leaders never win because they bring everyone with them to the finish line. For me, to lead is to humbly serve others in a practice. In a practice to become self-competent, to become aware. What do corporations call their people? Employees, associates, clients, and partners, right? What about politicians? Constituents, my party affiliate. What about the military? Brothers and sisters is what I hear a lot. You see, there's love in those terms for me. If we can all have the humility to question self, have the bravery to try, the courage to listen, to become more self-aware, then we can be brave in our practice of humility. And humble and are confident enough to be vulnerable, then perhaps we could see that we all have a real leadership responsibility as human beings to lead our brothers and sisters to help each other. That's my humbled opinion, I think, what it takes to be a leader. Love you.